I think there's an understanding in the United States, Mexico, and Canada that the final termination of native people is going to occur. Creche now sees his opportunity, and he's in the final stages of being prime minister, to really push the white paper through.
A genocidal mentality is inherently ecocidal in its implications. It eradicates the habitat that you, as well as we, depend upon for survival. You combine genocide and ecocide, you get omnicide.
Introducing a four-part series on CKUT 90.3. Legislation will be presented this spring, potentially changing Canada's relationship with Native North America forever. Tune into this station for long-term memory radio. A four-part series on Canada's relationship with Native North America every Wednesday throughout February from 5 to 6 p.m.
The liberation of Native North America becomes priority number one for anyone serious about ultimately winning the struggle at hand.
CKUT, long-term memory radio.
In 1884, the federal government of Canada asserted that they aimed to, quote, make Indians white men in the eyes of the law, end quote. Fast forward to 2002, and some would say that little has changed. The current federal government will be seeking to replace the Indian Act with the First Nations Governance Act and the First Nations Financial Institutional Act. While the Canadian government is seeking final solutions to unresolved Aboriginal treaties and other issues, the lack of consultation with natives and the focus on passing federal legislation leave some asking, are First Nations ready for the drastic redefinition of their rights and powers as this country's original peoples and owners? This four-part series of the Long-Term Memory Radio Project is dedicated to discussing the issues around the federal government's latest attempt to redefine its, and subsequently the Canadian people's, relationship with our Aboriginal neighbors. Part 1 will bring the Indian Act and the current legislation into focus. Part 2 includes a discussion about Native resistance movements and the media's systematically poor coverage of Native issues. Part 3 is dedicated to understanding how the Canadian government's policies have impacted Aboriginal women. And Part 4 will be produced by youth from Montreal's Native Friendship Center. Stay tuned for long-term memory radio on this station. Welcome to this four-part series on the Indian Act. Tonight we feature part one of this series about the future of Canada's relationship with Native North America. Recently, Anasazi, a magazine that seeks to critically understand governmental policies toward Native peoples, dedicated two issues to exploring the current changes that the Canadian government is seeking and their motives. Tonight's discussion expands Anasazi's feature on the Indian Act with the help of Roger Obanswin and Tony Hall. Roger is a member of the Abenaki Nation at Odanak, president of the OI Group of Companies, and editor of Anasazi. Tony is a professor of Native American Studies at the University of Lethbridge and organized a session at last year's People's Summit on the FTAA called American Indigenismo. I asked Roger why the Canadian government would be seeking to change its policies toward Native peoples now.
Well, they are getting extra pressures, and Tony can certainly talk about globalization better than I can, but those pressures are being felt in Canada, and they're trying to open up the land. The corporations are putting the pressure, and that's not only in Canada. I mean, I think there's an understanding in the United States, Mexico, and Canada that they're going to terminate, the final termination of Native people is going to occur, come hell or high water. And this is part of that agenda. The other reason is that Chrétien now sees his opportunity, and he's in the final stages of being prime minister, to really push the white paper through. He was really upset when Pierre Trudeau said that they would put it on hold. They continued to implement it, but that was a setback for him. And now he's seeing his chance, and the corporations are ruling the agenda. And this is the time to do it. Especially since the time limits is that we are finding out more about the agenda. We have more educated people. We have lawyers. We can fight back, which we couldn't do before. So it's a race. The quicker they can do it, the more they can prevent problems later on. And the longer it takes, the more difficulty we're going to have because they're going to get the backlash from the communities.
Tony, do you want to comment on that relationship between why this is happening now and furthering globalization, at least in Canada?
Well, what this transformation of the Indian Act is really about is transforming Indian communities into corporations. The aim of the Indian Act was always to lead to the municipalization of Indian communities. And to be a municipality, of course, is not to be a sovereign. It's to have your powers delegated, passed from a higher sovereign authority. And all corporations are created by the sovereign authority of governments. So this has been going on for some time. The Indian Reorganization Act in the United States created Indian corporations as the means of self-governance. The Alaska Claim Settlement in 1971 created 13 Aboriginal corporations in Alaska, and the idea is you turn in your Aboriginal rights, your right to land and resources. That very complex concept of what is the Aboriginal right, turn that in, and we will give you compensation, and we will give you corporate status. So that has been replicated throughout the North in the so-called treaties that the government have been making. And these treaties, you know, continue to include extinguishment clauses, surrender clauses, and set up corporations. And the idea is, of course, as it has been essentially since 1492, integration, assimilation, get Indian nationalities into the economy, into capitalism. So reform that Nault is talking about is, in a way, realizing the Indian Act's objective. It's interesting to go back into the history of the Indian Act. The first Indian Act was called an Act for the Gradual Civilization of the Indian Tribes in Canada. And it enabled a person, and this is really an important part of our history, an Indian person, a registered Indian person, who could prove he, and it only applied to males, he was civilized, and they actually had a test. And you had to name the continents of the world, for instance. If you could prove that you were educated enough, you could lose your Indian status, registered status, and become a citizen. There was a time when to get a university degree, any Indian who got a university degree would become a citizen. And to become a citizen, of course, is to become a person, to be entitled in law to vote, to be subject to the tax regime. So Indians were declared through the Indian Act, you know, historically to be non-persons and not to be able to access the courts, not to be able to take place in the land market. Place, for instance. And it's interesting that this disenfranchisement, which was, you know, in a sense what the Indian Act achieved or put in place happened around the same time that business corporations, first in the United States, but then everywhere where capitalism was developing, obtained the status of natural persons. It was a legal case in the United States, the Santa Clara case, where in 1886, finally corporations were able to identify themselves in law as having the rights and responsibilities of persons. They could go to court, they could sue, they could be sued. So just around the time that corporations, business corporations, were in a sense taking over the rights of human beings in the system, of citizens, Indian people were being taken out of the role of citizens, they were denied the citizenship in the First Nations, but also denied citizenship in Canada, and this was also going on in the United States or throughout Africa, for that matter, and being denied the ability to access due process, which corporations gained. So, in a sense, what we're seeing is a mop-up operation after taking Indian people out of the realm where they could access due process, take part in, you know, civil litigation, and defend their rights, of course, as non-persons, as wards of the government. They could not do this. So the government is basically saying, now, we will take away the burdens of wardship under which you have been, and you will become citizens of Canada, and you will become integrated in the system. You will, your lands will become subject to the higher laws of the Canadian state and the provinces, and we will integrate you as corporations, as municipalities, or, you know, throughout the North, the Inuvialuit, the James Bay Cree, the Saw-Too Dene, the Gwich'in, the Yukon people, now the Nisga. They have governments which are set up as corporations with delegated authorities, which in a sense terminates the sovereign powers of Indian nations and continues the cycle since 1492.
What has it meant that the Indian Act imposed a wardship condition among Indigenous communities in Canada, but also this new condition in terms of the style of government that the federal government is imposing on Indigenous communities today under the new treaty processes with band councils? I wonder if you can talk about the original structures under the versions of treaties that were precursors to the Indian Act to what is happening today with the band councils.
Well, when the Indian Act was imposed, and it was imposed, there was no discussions, it was imposed, there were governance systems in place that were autonomous, that were sovereign. So if we look at the Six Nations, for instance, they had the Confederacy, they had their Longhouse, and they had a systems for making decisions within the community without outside interference from governments. And there was agreement initially under the friendship treaties that that would continue. The imposition of the Indian Act broke that. And then in Six Nations in 1924, it ended up in some death. The government imposed the Indian Act systems by having an election whereby nine community people elected eight councillors. And the RCMP were there, and the Longhouse people were opposing that, the Confederacy, and some of them got shot. They were killed. And they said, now we're dealing with this band council and their authority, and the funds will flow through them. And they've used funds all along to control that, but also the Indian Act to control that system. So that now we're going into another phase of imposition. And the Governance Act is another imposition on people. It's still not recognizing that sovereignty, that autonomy, that right of self-determination, which is a right of a people to choose their own form of government or political institutions without coercion or outside influence. And that's never happened.
But if you look at the situation in the world today, how many governments in the world can be really seen as puppets? I mean, how much does the government of Saudi Arabia really reflect the will and political self-government of the Saudi Arabians. It's a puppet regime. Latin America is our puppet regimes. I mean, the development of the reserve system and the puppet control, the Indian agent and the Minister of Indian Affairs ultimately keep the power, and they work through, in a sense, puppet regimes. That's how the Indian Act was set up. And, you know, it creates a terrible situation in Indian country where you have a class situation now. You have a certain number of people who have assimilated into the Indian Act who can make it work for themselves and maybe their immediate families, and a large number of alienated, disenchanted, and disenfranchised Indian people who look at this and say, you know, it's been bad enough being exploited and oppressed by the government of Canada, but now our own people are implicated in doing it to us, and it's an issue that doesn't get talked about. You're going to talk about Dudley George, and you know, there was a tremendous amount of political division around that assassination, and the class situation in Indian country is really, really quite pressing and daunting right now.
There are examples. This is the irony right now, or the sad part. They're using the accountability issue and as a smokescreen. They're saying the councils have to be more accountable to the people, so we're going to develop a governance act. That's not the reason. If they wanted to look at accountability, they would look at a system that's more autonomous. There is a precedent in Cross Lake in Manitoba, the Pitchikamik Cree Nation. They declared that autonomy. They just went ahead and did it. The government is, and they got out of the Indian Act and are making their decisions within the community, passing their own laws without interference from Indian Affairs or having to ask them permission to do it. They have a consensus in the community in doing that, and it's a strong consensus, and they can govern from that. The government says they don't recognize that. So they said, fine, you don't recognize it, but the community recognizes it, so we'll govern ourselves that way. We could do it. We don't have to go through this charade of consultation or no consultation. We just have to have the political will within the communities to go out and do it. Our politicians are so busy fighting for the next dollar, and the next dollar is consultation monies, that nobody is sitting down and saying, let's just do it. And if it means civil disobedience, it's the only way you're going to do it. And I get insulted when somebody comes in and says, this is the kind of government you're going to have. They have no authority to define that for me.
You've been listening to a discussion with Roger Obanzwin, editor of Anazazni magazine, and Tony Hall, professor of Native American Studies at Lethbridge University. We'll be right back with Roger and Tony's expectations of what mainstream media's coverage will be like of these new policies, as well as what ideas and hopes they have for influencing the policies of the Canadian government. Welcome back to this four-part series on the Indian Act. Tonight we feature part one, bringing the Indian Act into focus because the Canadian government is attempting to amend it with new legislation. The First Nations Governance Act and the First Nations Financial Institutional Act will amend the Indian Act so that First Nations sovereign status will be changed to that of municipalities, effectively giving them less power than foreign corporations have in Canada. We've been talking with Roger Obonswin, editor of Anasazi magazine, and Tony Hall, professor of Native American Studies at the University of Lethbridge. I asked Tony what was the difference between the Indian Act and the treaty process.
Now let's get this sorted out here, because the Indian Act is legislation, and it exists in a very different sphere than treaties and the whole issue of Indian title to land. And of course, throughout British Columbia, for instance, that issue is unresolved. There are no treaties in most of British Columbia. The treaties come up in the Canadian Constitution in Section 35, where it said existing Aboriginal and treaty rights are hereby recognized and affirmed. So that's where the federal government should be placing its emphasis, on implementing Section 35. The Indian Act goes back to legislation in the province of Canada in the 1850s. I'm sure that if you asked a court to say, is the Indian Act legal? No, the whole Indian Act is illegal because it's inconsistent with Section 35, which recognizes and affirms existing Aboriginal and treaty rights. So treaties, by their very nature, speak to relations between sovereigns. It doesn't speak of a relationship between a sovereign government and a municipal delegated authority. Treaties speak of relationships between sovereigns. When, for instance, you're negotiating the free trade area of the Americas, why are Indigenous peoples not represented? Well, of course, there's been a history where a certain kind of treaty is considered only Europeans or their progeny are considered entitled to make those kind of treaties, going right back to the Pope giving the Americas to the government of Spain and Portugal in 1493. And I could just rhyme off, you know, the treaty after the American Revolution, the Louisiana Purchase, the Russia's sale of Alaska to the United States, Hudson's Bay Company's sale of most of what is now Canada to the Dominion of Canada, all these transactions, the attachment of BC to the rest of Canada, all these transactions, and it's throughout the Americas, do not have a stitch of Aboriginal consent, of Indian consent, and they go back to this old racist theory that there is a hierarchy of humankind, that some people are savage and some people are civilized, and some people are not entitled to participate in the highest levels of international law. And we see that with the free trade area of the Americas simply being repeated. Pierre George, Dudley George's brother, was at the fence and pulled down the fence. Dudley George was killed and assassinated in Canada in the latter years of the 20th century, and we have no political will to even find out about the political authority that did that or that brought in the army. Joint Task Force 2, which is now in Afghanistan, fought Indians in British Columbia in 1995. The federal government hides in the Indian Act, and surely the Indian Act is so terrible that some improvements could be made in that legislation, but it's legislation, and Constitution trumps legislation. We have a Constitution which recognizes treaties, and treaties speak of relations between sovereign peoples, and they are in international law. So this effort to domesticate, to bring Indian people under sort of the higher authority of the laws of the provinces and of Canada, you know, continues the old colonial process. And, you know, to exploit the fact that many Indian people say, and rightfully so, we don't have accountability, we can't get accountability from our leaders. But that's an issue for Indian peoples to deal with. That's an issue, for instance, the Assembly of First Nations should be, is an organization of Indian chiefs. That's no longer viable. Even the national chief, Matthew Kunkum, said he wanted to change that. Where's that voice now?
That's right. And we need to come together and really, what's needed is a constituent assembly where we bring our top minds together and we start to develop our own alternatives, separate from the Indian Act, separate from the control of any government, and we can do that.
And if you do it separately, though, Roger, what power do you have to keep the government of Canada from continually passing legislation. Just as recent as 1999, the Land Management Act was passed without consultation, as your article says in Anasazi, without consultation of any Indian peoples, and it calls for allows for the privatization of land and local taxation and the selling of land to off-reserve businesses and developers. How do you prevent that from still happening in the legislature if you're seeking out your own forms of consultation and negotiation and organization among your own people?
Well, first of all, the only reason they're able to implement that is that there's some band councils that go along with it. And it's the old adage of divide and conquer, but it's also in the Indian Act there used to be what they call the civilized bands. But the civilized bands are the ones that they define as civilized by the ones that cooperate with the department the most. So, and that's where I saw some hope in Matthews, as Tony was pointing out, as Matthews' comments, let's get out of that system. You can't use the Indian Act system to get out of the Indian Act. You have to develop your own systems, fully accountable to the communities. And then you can start implementing that. And they can huff and puff all they want. We have the leadership. There's two things that's happened. I hear, and it's very sad, you hear about signing these so-called modern-day treaties. Well, they're not treaties. They're agreements. And they say, well, it's not what we wanted, but we're tired. It's the best we're going to get. And so let's sign the agreement. I hear that over and over again. It's not what we wanted, but it's the best we're going to get. And some people are giving up. But instead of giving up, we should be coming together and looking at how we develop our own structures for passing the laws that are going to govern our communities. And the land is a very key issue in that. There are options. And those options are practiced in other countries, as I said, New Caledonia and in Western Samoa, where they maintain that because the colonial system stayed out of it. And they maintain and they own the land and they delegate it to the families and they have to look after the land. So there are models that can be applied. But too many people are giving up or getting totally caught into the system. And you have to pull back from that system and start to look at the communities and how you develop those communities.
Roger, you had dedicated a whole issue of Anasazi to discussing the Indian Act and what was possibly going to be passed in 2001. It has since been tabled, and your thinking is that it's possibly going to come up before Chrétien goes out, so we're looking at spring 2002. Can you discuss a little bit what the impacts or implications of this legislation, if it does indeed pass, is for different peoples, those who are treated, those who are non-treated, women, or people who live in urban areas? What does it mean for different members of indigenous communities?
Well, it means continued more of the same. They'll have some structures in place to ensure more accountability, but it's still governance without powers and titles. You have to have the powers and titles in the Governance Act.
It's municipal governance.
And as long as you don't have those authorities and titles within your own communities, then yes, you are municipal government. And that's what that's still what they just dress it up in different terms. And government stays up nights thinking of terms that they can use that will make it look different, but still achieve the same results. There is no difference. I go back to my point. What authority do they have over me, over our people? They have none, and we should understand that. And the more we tell them that they have none, the more we'll be strong as people. We have more to give them than they have to give us, and that's the land. So what are we fighting about? And if we lose that, then we're totally dependent on them. And the Royal Commission said it, the Penner Report said it, the Oberley Report said it. You have to include powers and titles. In 1934, when the Natural Resources Transfer Act officially transferred the resources to the control of the provinces, What they effectively did is they took our resources, which we could have built our self-governance on, transferred it to the provinces, and said, now you go to the province. The Chartered Lands Act then puts it into fee simple title. Chartered lands comes under provincial jurisdiction, and then we're municipalities. And then the federal government says, goodbye, we don't have a relationship anymore. You're a provincial and you're a municipality, and municipalities, as we very well know, have no powers, no titles, except what's given to them by the provinces.
Well, I would like to put this in a bit of context. You know, since World War II, we've lived in an era which some would describe as an era of decolonization. So, you know, much of the planet was, shortly following World War II, colonies of Europe. Britain withdrew from India in 1948, and then subsequently many of the countries in Africa achieved what was called self-government. This was done in the name of decolonization. But, of course, behind the scenes, there was a decision made at the highest level that none of this decolonization would be allowed to develop different kinds of property regimes, call it socialism, call it a range of things. And you had many innovative African leaders, Nkrumah, Nyerere, George Manuel, Shuswap man from British Columbia, who was the national chief of the National Indian Brotherhood, what is now the Assembly of First Nations. He worked very closely with these Africans. And essentially there was a covert policy, and this was part of the Cold War, of course, to just kill or take out leaders who were trying to do decolonization in a way that would create some sort of equity for their own people. And what you ended up with was, you know, Sekou Stacy, Mobutu in Congo, installed by the CIA, Sukarno, a million people killed off in Indonesia, essentially to make sure that a regime of property relations, capitalism, private property relations, was not disrupted by decolonization. And as I see the Land Management Act, or NALT's proposal, it's simply the process of trying to develop the world in such a way that all the world's resources, all the lands, all the resources will be subject to one law, one capitalist law. And from, you know, the World Trade Organization down to what's going on in local Indian politics, there is a tremendous push to favor the banking system, the government system, to favor those in the colonized world who want to advance this capitalistic privatization of lands and resources and basically everything there is in the planet to own, which gets right down into, you know, DNA and, you know, putting private title, freehold title on everything, privatizing everything. And what we see is a huge concentration of ownership in fewer and fewer hands, you know, real ruthlessness, whether it be at Genoa or Quebec City or Seattle, what we're going to see in New York, a real ruthlessness to say that any alternatives to this one approach to globalization will not be considered. And George Manuel in Canada came up with his vision of the fourth world. The fourth world is an alternative view of globalization. It's not a matter of being against globalization, pro-globalization, or anti-globalization. There's a number of ways that we can proceed, and a totalitarian world order based on, you know, one economic regime, capitalism, which must be forced right down to the reserve level, right into, you know, the so that you'll have Indian peoples with a few very rich Indians and many very poor ones, which is, you know, how it works everywhere in the planet. That's what we're seeing.
If I can add, in terms of something real that is happening and will happen more and more, that we are getting financial independent from the government. And if you are financial independent, then you have much more leeway in implementing what you want to implement. And I look at AFN and I see how, and all of the organizations, And I see how they try to do these things, and they get reined in by how the money is controlled. And their hands are tied. Now, since we've had the business, and I used to work in those organizations, since I've been on my own in business, I can generate income. Our employees are paying into our court cases, are paying into our fights, and it's our money. It's not coming from government, so they can't control us. And they know that, and we're a real thorn in their side because they can't do that. And they're trying to destroy us. Now, they may succeed in that, but there's going to be others that come up, and that's the way of the future, where they don't rely on government funds, the handout type of funds, and they can then start to really fight this. And that's going to happen. It's inevitable. And they're trying to close the loopholes before it comes to that.
Well, Roger, what kind of relationship would you like to see Indigenous communities having with the Canadian government? Some would suggest that the Canadian government should negotiate on a nation-by-nation basis because they stole land on a case-by-case basis.
No, well, I think we have to come together as nations first, as the different Native nations, and define that so that it's not divide and conquer again. They negotiate on a nation-to-nation basis because it's happened in Fort Niagara with Pontiac when they were signing treaties. They negotiated with individual nations one at a time and then picked the weakest ones to negotiate first. We come together and they negotiate as a group, but we have to establish the principles by which we govern ourselves. We have to have a negotiating point to go to them with, and those principles are autonomy. Now, that's something we work on internally, and then you've got something to negotiate with. And it all comes from the same voice. Yes, they're all different arrangements, but it's all the same situation. And we can come together on that. So what I'm saying to the leadership, and I'm very critical of our leadership, put aside all that talk and get down to the real talk of how we're going to do that together. Then we can face the government, and then they'll have to. But as long as they think they can play one against the other, they're going to be ahead.
And Tony, yourself as a non-native, as someone who is Canadian, how would you advise the Canadian government on these issues?
I look to an international approach, and it seems to me that part of this solidarity that we're talking about has to transcend the nation state. After all, Canada, what is Canada nowadays? It seems to me fairly clear that Canada is essentially a colony of the American Empire. My gosh, our armed forces are in Afghanistan under the direct authority of the American military. So we can't come up with a solution in this country without dealing with the issue of, to what extent is Canada a sovereign power? And in an era where the United States sort of retains a veto power over everything, we need to get a tremendous movement, which is what we were seeing at Seattle and Genoa. We need to realize the nature of what it is that is oppressing peoples in different ways, and it's the totalitarian reign of a single economic regime. To me, the real test of whether Indigenous people's sovereignty can be expressed is, can this sovereignty extend to the development of property law, to the elaboration of property law? And, what the Land Management Act or all of these proposed changes to the Indian Act do, continue to develop this idea that all the property will be brought under the authority of the sovereign regime of Canada and the provinces, which is in fact now a colony, now, subject to a higher sovereign. And these nation states are giving away their sovereignty to organizations like the World Trade Organization. And behind it is this military-industrial complex of the United States, which is in effect the highest authority. And so to see the sort of the opportunity involved in dealing with something like this Indian Act legislation. This is right down at the very roots of, you know, the how the laws connect to the resources of the earth. And in Canada, we have a very developed constitutional history of recognizing Aboriginal and treaty rights, going back to the Royal Proclamation. Why is it that we are negotiating treaties in Canada in the 21st century? In the United States, they simply passed a law in 1871 and said, essentially, conquest will prevail. We will no longer make treaties with indigenous peoples. We will depend upon our army. And essentially, the United States feels governed by no rule of law, isn't governed by the Royal Proclamation, isn't governed by the idea of Indian title or the title of people in Afghanistan or Saudi Arabia. Just like they fought Tecumseh to get land for 2 cents an acre north of the Ohio River, so, you know, the indigenous peoples in the Middle East are being essentially colonized so that cheap oil, cheap resources can flow into the global economy. We live in an era of true colonialism, and the oppressive powers are little by little being identified, and we've got to keep up the pressure at Kananaskis, for instance. It's very important that we not bow down to this idea that, you know, the governments are sort of the good guys, and anybody who opposes governments must be sort of in league with terrorists. This George Bush telling the world that, you know, either you're with us or you're with the terrorists. This is a kind of a terrorism, a psychological terrorism that we've got to stand up against. We've got to find the courage to stand up against.
Can I just add there's a simple solution. It's in the Royal Proclamation. Number one, get Indian Affairs out of the equation. Don't have Indian Affairs negotiating. Set up a separate Ministry of State for Aboriginal Relations to without funding authorities to start negotiations and to start developing an Aboriginal Canada Relations Act as true partners in Canada, as equals. And that's the recommendation that's been shoved aside.
Treaty
as long as Indian Affairs is involved in it, I'm not going to participate in that process.
You know, so far in the federal systems of the United States and Canada, we've seen federalism exercised as if it's a relationship between the central government and the provincial governments, or in the United States, the state governments. I mean, there's a third element here. There's the Aboriginal governments. And are those indigenous governments to be understood as municipalities, as a lower order, or are they to be acknowledged as equal to the other orders of government? It seems to me in the Charlottetown Accord in 1992, we did have some beginning of a consensus that Canada should be conceived as being composed of three types of government: provincial government, the central government, and Aboriginal government, and that those three orders of government are equal in a sense. That struck me as a very important breakthrough. And, you know, we don't see that, for instance, we don't see at first ministers' conferences where the federal government meets with the premiers. We don't see a vision of the Canadian state which acknowledges that indigenous peoples are a constituency entitled to and with a right to an equal order of government. Instead, you get this idea, well, you stand down as a lower order of government, we will represent you. For instance, when we go and negotiate the free trade area of the Americas, we'll ask your opinion. John Chrétien will take your opinion and then bring it to the negotiating table for the bargaining there. So there's huge implications of not being able to participate in the international venues in the making of international law. And surely, after, you know, more than 500 years, we should be saying that this is no longer acceptable, this sort of Darwinian idea that there are that there is one scale of civilization, and that savage people might be allowed as individuals to elevate, you know, and come into citizenship, but until that total assimilation and integration takes place, we'll keep this kind of wardship or subordinate status. That really is, it conjures up the old, you know, the most abhorrent colonial racist heritages, and puts them in the modern time. So we need to understand that history, come to grips with that history, and transcend this history, and start to conceive of Canada as being composed of three equal orders of government, not two, and to open up space in the international regime, open up space at the World Trade Organization, in the negotiation of the Free Trade Area of the Americas, and on and on and on to the acknowledgement that there's these very old polities in the earth, indigenous peoples, and that this isn't to be understood as a remnant, an obsolete or archaic remnant of our distant past, that this is contemporary. It's part of the fourth world reality that George Manuel was so visionary in teaching us about, and we need to reconceptualize and reform our institutions at every level, at the local, regional, national, and international, supranational, global level.
Well, I'm wondering if either of you are very hopeful that this huge issue and the criticalness of this issue. I mean, the Prime Minister has spoken about, you know, creating something final and certain out of this new legislation. Roger, where do you feel that the mainstream media will actually make the space to cover this legislation?
Well, they'll cover the perspective of government on it, which they have been doing already. And they bought the government line. That is totally because of the abuses at their level and the accountability issue, and that's what they're covering. And that's everything is based on that. But they're still not getting to the real issues. And the media, and it's a value system. They have the same value systems as the government has, as Krajan has. They're lazy. I faced that in Revenue Canada. We were getting some good coverage initially when we were in the occupation of Revenue Canada. But as they kicked in their machinery, the government kicked in their machinery after a week, and I talked to a reporter, and he said, well, I've got deadlines to meet. All the information is there, and they spoon feed it to us. That's what we're going to run with. So they've got a very sophisticated, and they're spending a lot of money on that public relations strategy, which includes how they use the media in that process.
I'm looking forward to hearing what Peter Edwards has to say. And he wrote a book on the murder of Dudley George. And Peter Edwards, I have great respect and appreciation for his important and good journalistic work. What his achievement points out to me, however, is that the comparative poverty and poorness of coverage of Aboriginal issues. Here we have, after all, an instance where an Anishinaabe man at Ipperwash was murdered by the police at Ipperwash. There's much indication that the OPP were not acting in a vacuum, and one would hope they weren't. They were under orders, and that those orders went to the highest echelon. They went ultimately to the Premier Mike Harris. So here it is now 2002, 7 years later, and in Canada we live in a political culture, and the political culture is largely shaped by the media, the journalists, where there isn't even enough public indignation and public care about our system that an Indian standing and asserting that his burial ground where his grandparents are born should not be, you know, made into a provincial park, or that the provincial park should be removed to respect this burial ground of his ancestors. A peaceful protester standing on that ground is murdered by the state, and then we don't get a public inquiry into it. The Human Rights Commission of the United Nations has specifically criticized Canada for that very thing, that we never got a public inquiry into essentially who killed Dudley George. And that just speaks to me about, you know, if we can't even get a proper coverage on that, and enough journalists to be informing the public sufficiently that they understand that, you know, once you have police going around literally murdering people on political orders, and there's a cover up, and the public, it seems, are willing to say and the journalists are willing to say, okay, we'll accept that. Same thing in 1995 in British Columbia. There was an Indian war in 1995 in British Columbia. The Canadian Army went in there. Landmines were used. You know, Canada makes this big issue about its leading role in the Landmines Treaty. Well, the last time Canada used landmines was domestically in British Columbia to try to preempt the, could I say, the militant wing of the Indian sovereignty movement, who were in a defensive posture making their stand. We can't even get illumination of that. The RCMP, part of what they were doing throughout that campaign was, that military campaign, was conducting what they called, and it's their words, a disinformation and smear campaign. In other words, Bruce Clark, Dr. Bruce Clark, Wolverine, splitting the sky, the various people who were making that stand and were very conscious about trying to force this issue of Indian title into some kind of venue, some kind of international venue. Essentially, they were sidetracked. The public didn't get to know about those arguments because officials in Canada did what they called, by their own terms, a disinformation and smear campaign. Leonard Peltier remains in prison. Beneath his case is the reality that at Wounded Knee in the 1970s, 100 AIM supporters, around 100 AIM supporters, were murdered by a paramilitary force of the local Indian chief, Dick Wilson. His paramilitary squads murdered dozens of Indian people on the Pine Ridge Reserve, just like perhaps 200,000 Indian people in Guatemala were murdered by paramilitaries. I mean, there is a huge unwillingness on the part of the media to go into what is really at issue here. And so if we can't even get proper reporting and honest reporting, if the journalists are willing simply to go along with the cover-up of state officials on these type of cases, what hope do we have to get the real story about you know, what the complexities of the politics of Indian country? Many Indian people found that the Nisga Treaty, for instance, they saw that as a sellout. They thought the Nisga gave up too much. And yet all the media reports is the Alliance Reform Party position that the store was given away. So we don't get proper coverage of the complexity of the politics within Indian country. We get PR people in government, you know, putting out these lines, developing this language, as Roger says, which makes it sound like there is sort of progressive developments happening in the area of Indian self-government. So the role of the media in these times, when the media is dominated essentially by a particular ideology which says that corporations should, you know, privatize as much of the planet as possible and that government should be pushed to the margins. I mean, this is what is behind the efforts to change the Indian Act, the idea that government essentially should be made as light as possible and the free enterprise capitalist system should prevail and be the primary forum where most of the decisions are made in life. I mean, that's the ideology, that's the bias that we're getting. And we don't see the complexity of what continues to be the decolonization struggle.
I think Peter did a fantastic job on that. What's ironic is that Peter, and any journalist, no matter how well-meaning he is, has to go through his editors and gets watered down. Peter had to write a book separate from the news media before it even got attention in the press. So he couldn't even use his own journalism within the process of the newspapers. He had to write a book before it got attention. So it only emphasizes the biases that are still within the press at the editorial level.
For anyone out there who's concerned about these issues, where can they go for more information rather than just relying on the mainstream or corporate media?
Well, we're going to continue with anesthesia. There is another issue that's just in the mail now that looks at alternatives. That's part of our role in doing that. We need to mount our own public relations campaign. Who's going to do that? I think there's beginning to be some of the provincial native bodies are starting to organize around resisting this, but they still need to develop the systems to get the proper information out. It's one thing to criticize; you have to develop the alternatives and then get those alternatives out there.
And do you still have issues, copies of Volume 7, Number 1?
Yes.
Okay. If anybody wants that and the current issue, how do they contact you?
1-800-461-9495, and we're reconstructing our website, and we'll be having that on our website, oigroup@oigroup.ca, after the end of the month.
Can you spell that out again?
oigroup@oigroup.ca.
Well, I guess on that note, we'll turn to part two of this discussion, which will be with Peter Edwards, who is with the Toronto Star, as well as Allison Black Duck, who is a freelance journalist. I thank you both for joining us here today.
Thank you, Gretchen.
Thanks, Gretchen.
Thank you so much for tuning in tonight to this first part of a four-part series on the Indian Act. Tonight you've heard from Roger Obonswin, a member of the Abenaki Nation at Odinak and president of the OI Group of Companies and editor of Anasazi Magazine. You've also heard from Tony Hall, a professor of Native American Studies at the University of Lethbridge and organizer of a session held at last year's People Summit on the FTAA called American Indigenismo. If you're looking for past issues of Anasazi or you'd like to inform your own resistance to these amendments, you can contact Roger at 1-800-461-9495. That's 1-800-461-9495. Or you can find that information at www.oigroup@oigroup.ca. That's oigroup@oigroup.ca. Stay tuned for part two of our four-part series with Arthur Miller, Sun Peaks activist, who will be speaking on the necessity of rural resistance for a native population that is only growing, and Peter Edwards, a staff writer for the Toronto Star, and Allison Black Duck, a freelance journalist and only native writer with a weekly column in a major newspaper. They will both be joining us for a discussion of what is right and wrong about the mainstream media's coverage of Native issues.
I think there's an understanding in the United States, Mexico, and Canada that the final termination of Native people is going to occur. Chrétien now sees his opportunity, and he's in the final stages of being Prime Minister, to really push the white paper through.
A genocidal mentality is inherently ecocidal in its implications. It eradicates the habitat that you, as well as we, depend upon for survival. You combine genocide and ecocide, you get omnicide.
Introducing a four-part series on CKUT 90.3. Legislation will be presented this spring, potentially changing Canada's relationship with Native North America forever. Tune into this station for Long-Term Memory Radio, a four-part series on Canada's relationship with Native North America every Wednesday throughout February from 5 to 6 p.m.
The liberation of Native North America becomes priority number one for anyone serious about ultimately winning the struggle at hand.
CKUT, Long-Term Memory Radio.